You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Welcome to the second part of a series covering the 1978 Clarenville, Newfoundland UFO sighting. If you're joining the story at this point, I have some words of caution. In this episode, references will be made to the events described by eyewitness Jim Blackwood in part one of the series. Unless you're already familiar with the events that took place on the waterfront that night, I think it's wise to back up and listen to part one before you go any further. Also, for those of you who have listened to part one but aren't following me on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, you may not be aware that I've also released a companion blog in which I share the documents, links, and news clippings that I've compiled during my research into this event. You can find that post at the blog section at nighttimepodcast.com. I've also included a link to the post in this episode's show notes. So with the warnings out of the way, it should be safe to now proceed with the assumption that I'm among company familiar with the Clarenville UFO event and with at least a basic interest in the mystery surrounding the broader UFO question. So let's get into it. For the main content of this follow-up episode, I've included a conversation surrounding the Clarenville event as well as the various themes introduced during the prior episode. To join me in this discussion, I've invited two people from the world of UFO study whose intelligent yet down-to-earth delivery of UFO-related content I admire a great deal. Fortunately, both the guests were agreeable, available, and well-versed in Jim Blackwood's sighting. The UFO enthusiasts out there listening are likely well acquainted with the two guests that'll be joining us initially, so I'll keep the introductions brief. Alejandro Rojas is editor, a writer, and radio host at the highly respected site openminds.tv. If you've ever read UFO content in the news, you've likely come across his story or references to his great work. Joining Alejandro and I is Martin Willis, who may be the world's most interesting man. He's an artist, a fine art and antiques appraiser, and the longtime host of the always incredible Podcast UFO, a weekly show featuring a who's who of ufology. Then after the discussion, and just prior to the conclusion of the episode, you'll hear in a separate segment a brief comment from past guest Chris Rutkowski, who the media has dubbed the Canadian UFO guy due to his longtime association with the phenomenon here in Canada. He has some interesting thoughts on the NRC's Jupiter findings. Now let's get to my discussion with Alejandro and Martin. We'll join the conversation with me asking a few questions about their shows. We'll start with you, Alejandro. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about what you do at Open Minds?
Yeah, we're essentially a multimedia, mostly news organization when it comes to UFOs. So we post UFO news on a daily basis. We post headlines, but we also have stories about sightings or what's going on in the UFO fields. We also do YouTube videos. We're big on social media. And we run the International UFO Congress, which is the largest UFO conference. And we do that every year in the Phoenix area here in February.
You were in the news a lot for the UFO conference because you gave the Researcher of the Year award to Tom DeLonge, ex-lead singer of the popular punk band Blink-182.
It was definitely very controversial that we gave him the award. Tom DeLonge left Blink-182 to become a UFO researcher. His bandmates did not agree, you know, necessarily with the direction he was going in. He did recently put out a nonfiction book. It is sort of a ancient aliens type of thing. But what really puts this over the edge is from the WikiLeaks that happened during the election. So John Podesta, who is the manager of Hillary's campaign, he's been really into UFOs, and they leaked his emails. And in those emails, we saw he had conversations with Tom DeLonge about UFOs. And John Podesta arranged a meeting with a couple generals and a vice president. So the generals, one was in charge of the labs at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. As Tom DeLonge notes in one of the emails, that's where he doesn't say allegedly. I will add that word. But allegedly, the spacecraft from Roswell was sent. The other person is a vice president of Lockheed Skunk Works, which is a group that built and manages Area 51. So these are a lot of high-level people. So that's what justified us. Not only that, it's been kind of a slow year when it comes to UFOs. So when you really stack up what are the big things that were done in the last year, I can't see anything that really overshadows what Tom DeLonge has done. So justifiably gave him the Researcher of the Year award. And I think it's been helpful. It caused a lot of news stories recently. And the good thing about that, once we launched the, we put on YouTube his response, because I've had some contact with him and he did give us a video kind of thanking us for the award. And we put that up on YouTube along with a video that explains what I just explained now. And so a lot of press. And I think personally that that's all positive for the most part. Now, most of the press is just making fun of Tom DeLonge, and they're not talking about the content. However, a lot of the bigger news sources who do more of their due diligence around, you know, stories like this have gone into detail. And so it is getting the word out there. It's getting at least, you know, millennials seeing one of their mentors, one of the people they grew up with and look to being out and about his belief that there's something going on here.
Yeah. And he's, you know, a ton of notoriety, and he's also an interesting guy. Even the thank you video he submitted to the conference that you mentioned you aired on YouTube, he even had like kind of these vague references to what he's planning in the future. And it just really made you want more. So even if at the end of the day, if nothing new comes out of it, he's going to get a lot more people interested in the phenomenon. His books are selling like hotcakes, it seems. So it's definitely a good thing for, you know, for people, I'll call them UFO enthusiasts. It's definitely a good thing to have someone like him, you know, waving the flag, I guess, so to speak.
I agree. I think so.
Mm-hmm. And now for you, Martin, I put a post up on Reddit maybe 3 or 4 months ago, just asking people to recommend to me some podcasts that cover the UFO phenomenon. And yours was one that, you know, 5 or 6 commenters were like, you know, you got to listen to podcast UFO. This Martin's the best. So I downloaded like your 2 most recent episodes. And your show, I think, is Martin, is almost like the front lines of, you know, UFO news and stuff that's going on. You're just kind of in the trenches, just talking it out with, you know, a different guest from the field, you know, every week. And also lately you're now on YouTube doing the live video with the chat room and the whole thing. So it's kind of taken the podcast to the next level. So I probably did some of your work for you there, but could you just tell us a bit about podcast UFO?
Yes. Hey, thank you for that. Well, it's been a fun journey. Now it started in 2011. It's kind of just like finding out what UFOs are all about. We don't know where it's going to progress from here either, you know, as far as the mystery of it all. I really enjoy doing the show for probably the same reasons that both you and Alejandro also enjoy doing the show, and that is to talk to some, you know, very intelligent people that have ideas on the subject. You know, there's some interesting cases that you hear about, just so many unexplained UFO sightings that are just really, really fascinating, that keeps me passionate for the subject. And that's why I enjoy doing the show.
Yeah. And I think one thing the three of us have in common is I know when I hear a UFO story or when I consider it, I like to keep it fairly grounded. I think some people may say like nuts and bolts or something. I like to just keep it down to earth with the discussion. And I find both of your shows do that incredibly, and open minds, like when you do the news report that I read on Twitter and stuff all the time, it's fairly set, you know, in a grounded way. Is that something you're intentionally doing, or do you find it's just that's what interests you both?
It's for me both. It's what interests me, but it's also by design, in that when I write or do anything, it's with the assumption that the listener or viewer or reader has no knowledge about UFOs. And the point is, we're trying to get information out to people who are interested. And I think, kind of like you said, people get turned off if you start throwing out names or cases, and they don't know what the heck you're talking about. So if they don't know what you're talking about, they're not going to listen. And a lot of people, you know, don't spend as much time as we do on this, so they're not going to know this stuff. So I try to take more of a mainstream media approach to it, convey the information, but not opinion, even though so much mainstream media is all about opinion these days, which is unfortunate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Martin's the same. We're not trying to do a religious show here about belief. We're trying to convey credible information so that we can all kind of figure out what the heck's going on.
One thing that makes the sighting so unique, in my opinion, is the credibility of the witness, or the main witness that came forward, Jim Blackwood, where at the time that he saw what he saw on the waterfront, he was working as an RCMP constable. So he was in a small town, so a well-known guy who had really nothing to gain by getting himself mixed up in the UFO phenomenon. He was just an everyday small-town cop who saw something, went public with it. So to me, the credibility of the witness has such a big impact on, you know, how I feel about the event. Could either of you talk about that, how you feel the credibility of the witness affects your interest in a sighting?
Sure. Well, in this particular case, James Blackwood, you know, I watched a video of his interview that he did on this back in 1978, and he really seems like a very credible person while he's talking, and there's nothing at all that he had to gain by it. And I think when that's the case, when someone has everything to lose and nothing to really gain by coming out and being honest about a situation like this, to me, that gives them a lot of credibility, even more than some videos that you see or good photographs. To me, this is more important.
Right. I totally agree with that. That's a great point. It comes back to the motivations. And yeah, Blackwood had nothing to gain from coming forward. If anything, you know, they get teased and they get made fun of. And I've talked to police officers where that does happen. They report something and they get made fun of. So police, I think, are excellent witnesses, very credible. And what's really funny about his motivations, he said he didn't really want to talk about this stuff, even when this story got big and the media started coming to them, but he was ordered to. So the only reason he's telling people about the UFO and doing these interviews is because his superiors, surprisingly, ordered him to take every interview that came. And so he says for 2 weeks, you know, he's talking to the media about this case, kind of begrudgingly so. Which reminds me of another great case, which is the Rendlesham Forest case, where you know, a deputy base commander at a U.S. Base. It was actually leased from the U.K. This was a base in the U.K. And he and others, multiple witnesses, saw something kind of like this case. And he didn't want to talk to the media either. But his memo that he wrote about the case to the Ministry of Defense in the U.K. was leaked. And it went out to the press. So it was kind of the same thing where the press started coming to him. And he was more motivated by, he wasn't told to talk to the press, but he was more motivated by setting the record straight, because there were people out there making bombastic claims. And he was just frustrated by that. And his motivation to this day is to say, no, you know, a lot of this side stuff is BS. Here's what happened. So still, these people who, they don't want to come forward, but they're kind of forced to. That adds a ton of credibility as well, I think.
Yeah, I also find if a witness to a UFO sighting is into the UFO phenomenon, to me that takes it down a notch. And this is one where,
good point.
Yeah, he had no interest in it at all leading up to it, or really since it. When I was talking to him, I was asking him, like, you know, in Canada, this is a fairly well-known sighting. So I was saying, you know, you must hear from UFO enthusiasts often. And he was telling me that once he was invited to a convention and he went, And he just talked about how out of place he felt, but he did run into Stanton Friedman, but he didn't, when he was telling me about it, he was getting his name wrong. I think he was calling him Frederick Stanton. He was like, I didn't meet that Frederick Stanton guy, but I could tell that this isn't a man that's reads about UFOs or has any interest in it. He almost knows about it as if, like, if you got in a car accident and you got taken on in an ambulance to the hospital, and then 6 years later somebody asked you about that ambulance ride, you'd be like, I'm pretty sure there was like a nurse type person in there. That's kind of the way he talked about the UFO phenomenon. It was just this little thing that kind of flashed in and out of his life. And to me, that's important. I've seen so many people, especially online, they'll put up, you know, the photo they've taken of a UFO last week, and they think it's a big thing. But then if you look at their prior posts, it's all UFO stuff, and, you know, they follow all these UFO places. To me, that almost, I don't know, that takes everything down a notch in terms of credibility.
I agree, and unfortunately, there is this phenomenon where people will see something extraordinary that they believe is a UFO, and sometimes it is a genuine unknown, something really strange. But then they fall into this thing of looking at the sky and assuming that all of these other things that aren't UFOs are UFOs in the sky, and that's a danger. That's something you have to look out for with witnesses, which is similar to what you're describing, and I agree with you 100%. Yeah.
For me, I went to school for photography, and being someone who's into photography as well as any aspect of the paranormal, they don't go together, because so many photo and video evidence, it's so easily explained to somebody who has an understanding of the way, you know, cameras and film works. Same thing with you know, like the ghost investigations and all these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. If it's ever photo and video evidence, I almost don't even want to see it. I'd rather just sit down with the person and have them tell me the story. And there is so much photo and video evidence out there. Have either of you seen anything photo or video related to the UFO phenomenon that really grabbed you?
You know, there's a saying out there as far as UFOs go, like, if it's too good, then they won't believe it. But why are they always blurry? That's kind of what you hear a lot. I guess Alejandro and I may agree on one, the Puerto Rico UFO incident. There's a video on that. Maybe you can go into that a little bit, Alejandro, because that to me is that's an incredible video.
It was a video that was leaked by Homeland Security, actually Customs and Border Patrol in Puerto Rico, which is part of Homeland Security. And essentially, the people on board the craft who captured this IR video, one of the pilots had seen a light off the coast moving, and then it disappeared. So they trained their IR light, IR camera, which captures heat signatures instead of light, and they were able to see the object. And they tracked it come in off the coast and then leave over the ocean again. And they didn't know what the heck this was. So they say they submitted it to their bosses, and the bosses then got a hold of the Air Force, and the Air Force said, we don't know what it is. Maybe you should talk to some civilian UFO organization. And so they did. They didn't get clearance to release it or anything. They just went and went to some local UFO investigators, and they put together a group to investigate it. It took them 2 years to analyze it. And they couldn't figure out what the heck it is. So that's a really good one. But videos like that are really rare. And there aren't a whole lot of great videos and pictures out there, I don't think. Some of these older pictures, we've got a database of older pictures we've got from an older researcher. And some of these are pretty weird because they're pre-Photoshop. But I think you made a great point there in that the witnesses are so important. You know, I was in this before we got as many pictures and videos as we have now. But now that photos and video have become more common, they're not as helpful as we thought they might be, because you can't often tell what the heck it is you're looking at. Most of the big cases, and I think maybe you two would probably agree, this being one of them, the case we're talking about here, is if you think of these good cases, it's actually the witnesses. It's actually cases where there are very credible witnesses as opposed to pictures or videos. To kind of punctuate this too, I always think of the end of Close Encounters. I love Close Encounters. And at the end, when the mom is leaving, she's taking pictures of the aliens and stuff. And then they get out of there. Think if that happened in real life. Some lady is part of, you know, she witnesses her son's taken. This whole thing really happens. She gets her son back, and before she's leaving, she takes pictures of the government with these aliens and this UFO and gets out of there. Who's going to believe those pictures? Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to believe those pictures. So it's an example that, you know, pictures themselves aren't enough. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. What one sighting, like where I'm from, I'm Nova Scotia in Canada. We have a famous sighting here, the Shag Harbor incident. I know, Martin, you're familiar. Alejandro, are you familiar mm-hmm. with that sighting?
Oh, yeah, very. Oh,
okay. We have the 50th anniversary is coming up in October, and there's a big festival to celebrate it. So if you ever are planning a trip to Canada, that's the time to come. That's October, October coming. That's be a big deal. But that sighting is one where there was, you know, a slew of people on the waterfront. None of them are taking photos, but they're all still sharing the story. And that sighting now is so well known just from, you know, a handful of government documents that came out that referenced it. But mainly it's, you know, credible witnesses describing in a coherent way what they saw that night. There is one photo from Shag Harbor, and I think it's one of the more interesting UFO photos. And what's cool about this, I don't know if either of you seen the photo, but unrelated to the sighting, there was a guy that lived in the area, and he had a wooden boat that he used for fishing, and the boat was old and out of service or whatever. Like, I don't know if it didn't float or what, but he had it pulled up on the beach, and as a goodbye to his boat, he was setting it on fire. So what he did was he lit the boat on fire, and with his camera, he did a long exposure, like over the course of, I think, 5 minutes or something. But what ended up happening is as the shutter was open during this 5 minute exposure, that's when some of what was going on in Shag Harbor went on. And when you look at the photo, you can see motion in the stars because over 5 minutes, the stars are slowly moving. So they create a little line. But there's two or three lights. I think it's two red and a blue light that are out of sync with the way everything else is moving. And this is, and it kind of matches what some of the witnesses to Shag Harbor described. This photo was also taken in the late 60s on film, which is a lot harder to fake because you can really zoom in and see the grain and, you know, and see that it hadn't been modified. But of all the photos of, you know, UFO evidence I've ever seen, that has to be, I think, the only one that I've, you know, consider credible. But maybe I'm biased because it just so happens that it was taken an hour away from my house.
I have not seen that photo, and it sounds fascinating, so I would love to see that.
There's a documentary that was filmed about the Shag Harbor incident where they actually do maybe a five-minute segment within that documentary where they interview the photographer and they look at the photo and all this. But with this sighting in Clarenville, although there isn't a photo, we've established that the witness, Constable Blackwood, extremely credible. His claims are pretty fantastic, like what he describes happening on the waterfront. He talked about, you know, looking at it through binoculars, through the naked eye, through what he called a ball scope, which everything I looked into just kind of seems like a really strong telephoto lens sort of telescope sort of thing. He also talked about communicating back and forth with the object by flashing the lights on the top of his car. Overall, you know, on the surface, it's quite fantastic. And you would think with, you know, a story that's that amazing, you would need some type of evidence to back it up.
I kind of disagree with you a little bit on that. This is such a fleeting thing oftentimes. And what would a picture have done? It was at such a distance where the only way he could make anything of it at all, how it was lit up underneath and the blue lights that were flashing and all that, was by getting a really close look at it. So I don't think that a picture or, you know, anything else would have done any more for him. I just personally think that this one stands on its own, you know, because of a witness testimony. And I think that's enough sometimes.
Yeah. And I think even now that I'm thinking about it, even if there was a photo, it would just be, you know, a black square with a little white dot in the center. And all it would probably do in the end is just distract from him telling the story, which is, again, we've established the most effective way to get this across.
Which is, it's kind of a funny point because there are times when photos, just because they don't look impressive compared to the witness testimony, makes the witness testimony less exciting. And that does happen, even though the photos are still anomalous, where we can't say for sure what's in the photo. So, yeah, I don't know. It would be difficult to capture something like this on a video or on a photo, or at the time maybe film. It would have been great if it would have. But the problem is, even with the Lonnie Zamora case, is it's still just anecdotal information. And, of course, people are fallible. I think a police is a better witness than someone in the general public who doesn't have any experience. You know, police are often out there and they're asked to describe things and report on things, and they're out in the night, you know, driving around and everything. So I think they're better at that. But even though this is a great case, I think the witness is very credible. Like you said, the way he reacts, his motivations, all of these things lead towards them genuinely seeing something they could not describe. Just because they couldn't describe it doesn't mean that it's something unworldly or completely, not man-made. So it's tough. That's the tough part of this field, is when your best evidence is anecdotal, that really isn't enough. And I would agree with the people who say that isn't proof. That isn't a smoking gun. And we don't really have a smoking gun, but we do have a lot of information that leads us to believe there is an interesting, there's a phenomenon here. There's a mystery. But anecdotal information is just not enough.
Yeah, and there's absolutely something going on. And even for the people like I have my show, I cover different topics all the time. So I'll do true crime, then a mystery, then a paranormal thing. So there are a lot of people that when I'll do a UFO sighting story, they'll say something like, I can't believe you believe in UFOs. And it's not, you can't say like believe in them. There's no question they exist. Like if you take like, say, the Shag Harbor incident, if you just put on paper, you know, what happened and ask somebody to explain what that object could have been, they're not going to be able to identify it. Thus, it's an unidentified flying object. Mm-hmm. Same with, you know, the Phoenix Lights or Rendlesham. There's no question that something happened and people haven't been able to explain what it is. So whether you believe in, you know, little green men or high-tech government airplanes and stuff that, you know, aren't common knowledge yet, there's something going on and it's absolutely a mystery. There's so many stories from all around the world that a lot of people have thought about and tackled and haven't been able to explain, but it's quite amazing, I think. And I enjoy the stories and the storytelling and the people that are involved. Like in this case, Jim Blackwood is such a down-to-earth guy, and he's such a cool, likable guy. I love talking to him, and I loved hearing his story. And the fact that something so anomalous would happen to a guy like this is, you know, if there is gods up there, this is like a little favor they've done for us. They're like, let's just, you know, send one of those UFOs down and get a small-town cop to see it, and, you know, we'll pick Jim Blackwood. But I think it's very cool. And just getting back one last time to the idea of him capturing a photo that night, I'm kind of thinking now of like the really good horror movies. Well, maybe not the really good ones, but the almost really good horror movies are good up until the point that you actually see the monster, and then it kind of loses it. Like, so when you kind of hear the monster and it kind of zips by really quick and you don't get a full glance at it, there's so much suspense. But then all of a sudden when you get the clear high definition shot of the thing screaming at the camera, you're just kind of like, ah, all that. And that's maybe how I feel about photos with the UFO sighting. Jim telling the story to me, I'm on the edge of my seat like, yeah, and then what happened? And then what happened? But if he then pulled out a photo and we just saw this, you know, again, black square with a little white dot in the center, I'd be like, oh, that's what you saw? So it's maybe people should just stop taking photos of these things.
It's a great point. And, you know, along those lines, a lot of people just see a light in the sky. So, for instance, in Rendlesham, where they see this large light in the sky and it beams down a light, if they just took a picture and there's a light in the sky, big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had a couple of sightings of lights in the skies doing weird stuff. But if I would have taken a picture of a still, you got stars and everything, it would have been like, you know, this out of all of these little dots of lights that you see in my picture, this is a weird one right here. Mm-hmm. And people will be like, yeah, okay, buddy, you know,
yeah.
To your point.
Yeah. Now, with this sighting, it was investigated, and the NRC, like the National Research Council, they did release findings, that being that what Jim and the crew saw that night was the planet Jupiter. What led them to that conclusion was, I guess, this time of year, when Jim saw what he saw, this time of night, the direction that he was looking, I guess for whatever reason, Jupiter is very... very obvious and brilliantly lit. And they were pretty convinced that that's what he saw. When I asked him to tell me about what he thought of the NRC's findings, that what he saw for that 2-hour period was the planet Jupiter, he almost laughed it off, and he absolutely did not believe in any way that what he saw was Jupiter. Again, he talked about viewing it through the high magnification telescope. He said he could see the metal, he could see a fin on it. It was moving around almost like it was searching for something. It wasn't just hovering in the sky. He had no question in his mind that it wasn't Jupiter. I'm thinking back to one of my favorite episodes of X-Files, Jose Chung's From Outer Space, that had Jesse the Body Ventura playing a man in black.
No other object has been misidentified as a flying saucer more often than the planet Venus.
Really?
Venus was at its peak brilliance last night. You probably thought you saw something up in the sky other than Venus, but I assure you, it was Venus.
I know what I saw.
Your scientific illiteracy makes me shudder, and I wouldn't flaunt your ignorance by telling anyone that you saw anything last night other than the planet Venus. Because if you do, you're a dead man.
Yeah, I love that one. That's hilarious. Roswell.
Yeah.
Yeah, the problem, you know, it's disingenuous of, I think, those groups to do that. And they, like he describes, they didn't even interview him or any of the witnesses before coming to their conclusion. And astronomers especially do this a lot. Now, they do understand that a lot of times people misidentify what they're seeing in the sky. But still, you know, to say that it's definitively Jupiter without talking to the witnesses is, yeah, it's disingenuous. And not all astronomers do that. A lot of times news will consult a local astronomer. And sometimes the astronomers will say, well, it could be this, but their testimony doesn't really fit that because they said it did this. So I don't know what that might have been, but it very well could have been, you know, something man-made or something in the skies that they don't know. That's a more honest answer. But yeah, it is frustrating, and it happens a lot when these people, it's ego, and they just feel they know better, just kind of are so dismissive about sightings. And it's unfortunate because they're not really doing science at that point. They're just kind of boasting, and they're overstepping, you know, their expertise and being disingenuous. I don't think that any of them should be definitive if they don't know for sure.
But I guess when you're investigating it, really, what can you do if there's not, you know, photo or video evidence? All you can really do, I guess, is think of what could have been in the sky that night. And if there's something you could point your finger at, like Jupiter, I guess that, like, I don't know how Jim and his people could have, you know, debated it. Like, all they could really do is say what they saw, but it would then just be, you know, kind of like a he said, she said thing.
You got to at least ask the witnesses, because some of the witnesses might have said, oh, no, we saw Jupiter. We were sure it wasn't Jupiter. They might have said, in fact, that's what we were looking at, Jupiter, when we saw that this other thing kind of come in. So you've got to ask, just to ask, just find out if they knew where Jupiter was, and they were certain that this thing was not Jupiter. So you've got to at least do your due diligence and talk to the witnesses.
Yeah, and I think it as far as the people on the ground and the people of Clarenville, the official findings that it was Jupiter didn't seem to change things because, you know, he described in my interview, like this UFO craze just swept through the town and swept through Newfoundland, really, when this was in the news, because this was getting international attention and Clarenville's not a big place. So this, for, you know, for a year or two, it was really put the town on the map due to its, you know, connection with the UFO phenomenon. And one of my favorite parts of my talk with Jim Blackwood was him describing within the town all the little things that were happening, like the car dealership was having a UFO sale, and the local hotel, if you know, they had a special where for a certain amount of money they would give you like a star map and binoculars, and you could rent like the top floor rooms to watch UFOs from. But the whole thing was quite incredible.
You always hear when there's a spectacular sighting, such a mundane answer, you know, Jupiter, when this thing was said to have flashing lights on the top, and when it turned around, there was another blue light flashing on the other side. You know, I mean, that is never addressed in any of these debunking claims.
Yeah, Jupiter doesn't flash lights back at you. As little as right. I know about, you know, about the different planets out there, I've never seen them, you know, flash back. And he was pretty convinced that that happened. I only wish I had been able to speak to some of the other people that were there that night. I tried to track them down, and sadly, the guy who actually phoned the police to have Jim respond, he had passed away about 10 years ago. So it would have been really nice to talk to him just to get, you know, two people telling the same story.
The other thing I wanted to mention that was unique about this case is just how cool it is that years, decades later, he still had this video and that he posted on YouTube of his own volition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very cool. And it's also very cool that he found fame again. I don't know if you know about this, Alejandro, but he's now a famous YouTuber known as the Raccoon Whisperer. He lives in the middle of nowhere and he feeds raccoons out of his house. Well, that's what it started. But now he, in some of his videos, he'll be sitting on the couch and there'll just be 20 raccoons crawling all over him, you know, eating off his shoulders and stuff. But he's just a very interesting guy.
Pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Great. But I guess with that, we'll start to wrap this up. So any of my listeners who are interested in UFO stories and want to dig deeper into the topic, definitely check out Open Minds and definitely tune into Podcast UFO on the YouTube stream. That's become my Wednesday night ritual.
That's great.
Great. Well, we'll wrap it up with that. Is there anything else either of you want to add before we finish up?
No, I guess all I want to say is thank you very much for having me on. It was a lot of fun to talk about this case. I think it's great that you're focusing on it and you were able to speak to Jim, because this really is a great case.
I hope you enjoyed listening to that conversation as much as I enjoyed participating in it. I'm such a big fan of both Alejandro and Martin, and it was truly an honor to have them join me. Now, before I conclude this episode, I want to share some moments of a recent conversation I had with Chris Rutkowski. Listeners of this show may recall his appearance during my series covering the Shag Harbor UFO sighting. Seeing as Chris is a living Canadian UFO encyclopedia, I reached out to him to ask him for his opinion on the NRC's findings. Again, they felt Jim Blackwood most likely was looking at the planet Jupiter that night. I really wanted to include what Chris said at the end of this episode to provide some balance, as Martin, Alejandro, and I didn't give much thought to the official explanation. So here's Chris Rutkowski.
You know, I know that the police officer is absolutely sure that it wasn't a star or a planet, but the star or planet was actually right there. So it kind of makes you wonder what was actually being seen.
When I read, actually one of the articles that you had sent me had a couple paragraphs written by somebody who had the opinion that it was the planet Jupiter. And I guess that time of year in that direction, you know, it would be very bright and, you know, brilliantly lit and whatnot. So,
well, and not just in that direction, like literally right there and close to the ocean. It'll dance around and get extended and do all sorts of interesting things. So, you know, it's pretty convincing, but, you know, like you say, you weren't there standing next to him, so we don't know.
That's a thing. One thing that he talked about was he was using the roof lights on his police cruiser. He was flashing them, and he thought the object was flashing back.
That's pretty common, actually, that people will think that if they use flashlights or something at distant lights, that they're going to somehow increase in brightness and all that sort of stuff. It's pretty common with lots of UFO cases, but the reality is that it's because you're actually flashing a light, your eyes are interpreting the intensity change of the object based on what the intensity that you're throwing out at the object too. So it's actually an optical illusion. So it's really, you know, like I say, there's a lot of interesting things that, and of course the other thing is that he was using binoculars, and you know, which means that it really wasn't very close to him at all.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, and even beyond binoculars, at one point he got he actually left the scene from where they were watching it. He drove to the police station and got this thing called a ball scope, which is like a handheld telephoto lens, basically. That's about 60 times magnification. So he drove to the station, got that, and returned. So a lot of what he looked at was through well beyond binoculars, basically a telescope.
Yeah, that's, and again, that's something that close to the ocean would really distort quite significantly. So, you know, I'm not calling him a liar because I know he saw something. It's just that it's really just playing tricks with the eyes.
Although I'm no closer to understanding what Jim Blackwood saw that night, we'll conclude tonight's episode of the Nighttime Podcast. I'd like to thank Alejandro Rojas and Martin Willis. I couldn't recommend Open Minds or Podcast UFO more. I'd encourage you to check them both out if you're looking for more UFO-themed content. A great starting point for Podcast UFO would be a recent episode where I appeared as a guest discussing Canadian UFO sightings as well as my personal experience with the phenomenon. Also, a big thanks to Chris Kwiatkowski for his expert opinion. You'll hear much more from Chris in the future as he'll be a featured guest on an upcoming episode. And lastly, I'd like to sincerely thank Jim Blackwood for sharing his incredible story with me. I've been in touch with Jim since the release of episode 1, and he was touched by the many wonderful comments he's received from listeners of the show. Also, Jim agreed to allow me access to the master copy of his UFO press conference video. I'm planning to have the video digitally remastered to preserve this important piece of Canadian UFO history. If you're interested in hearing more content, please check out the Nighttime Patron Group, where for $1 a month, you'll have access to my bonus content. You can join the group by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. That's patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. On behalf of myself and the show's listeners, I'd like to thank the continued support of the current patrons and welcome the newest members to the group, Brian, Yvonne, Sean, and Malcolm. Without you all, the production of the show would be impossible. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Nighttime Podcast. If you enjoy your time here, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show on whichever podcast platform you use. To stay up to date, follow me on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram, where my handle is @NighttimePod. If you have any story ideas or feedback on the show or anything to say at all, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. So until next time, keep looking up and let me know if you see anything weird.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.